Hello and welcome to episode 29 of Not Reserving Judgment, a podcast about the latest intrigues, triumphs, and outrages in Canadian constitutional law. I'm Josh DeHaas, counsel with the Canadian Constitution Foundation.
I'm Joanna Barron, executive director of the CCF. Christine is off this week.
In today's episode, we'll discuss the Supreme Court's privacy-protecting decision that found police require warrants to get your IP address.
We'll share our bad legal takes of the week, where we take a lighthearted look at some of the legal opinions that did not quite land.
But first, I'm going to give you some good news on the four-year anniversary of when the world shut down for COVID-19, which is that at least 10 Ontario nurses who were cruelly fired for not getting vaccinated in 2021 can finally go back to work if they so choose. I'm talking about a new decision from labor arbitrator James Hayes, who has overturned an unreasonable and, in my opinion, vindictive mandatory vaccination policy that resulted in 10 unvaccinated nurses losing their jobs. The decision is called Quinty Health and Ontario Nurses Association, and it was a challenge to the provincial union to the policy of a hospital in Eastern Ontario that was put in place in fall 2021 and that remained in place until this decision. It appears to be the first decision of its kind, in Ontario at least, that found termination of unvaccinated nurses was not reasonable. So some background here. Quinty's policy was put in place in September 2021 in response to a directive by Ontario's chief medical officer of health, who said that hospitals needed to have a mandatory vaccination policy in place. You may recall that this was done rather reluctantly in Ontario because the province was quite worried about losing nursing staff, but the government was facing constant pressure from the media to force more vaccinations on those the small minority of healthcare staff who weren't vaccinated. And I think the government probably thought they had no choice, but the directive they did put in place was not as extreme as it might have been. It allowed for a little bit of choice. It said that those who were unvaccinated had to provide either a valid medical reason for refusing vaccination, of which there were only a couple that they were willing to accept, or if they still refused, unvaccinated nurses could still go to work as long as they endured a re-education program, i.e. watched a video about the safety of vaccines, and did regular antigen testing. Now, Quinty Hospital, like most hospitals in Ontario, decided that rather than doing what the province had proposed and allowing staff to maintain their bodily integrity and privacy by providing a testing alternative, they would simply fire people who refused to get vaccinated by Halloween of that year. And it seems crazy to fire nurses in the middle of a pandemic that's putting unprecedented strain on the healthcare system. But this was the height of this sort of burn the witch phase of the pandemic. These were the days when people were so angry that they were, you know, cheering on the federal decision to deny employment insurance to the unvaccinated and to kick them off of planes and trains. So revenge was in the air. Thankfully, we still have some laws in this country. And so the test in labor law is whether the employer's policy strikes a reasonable balance between the objective and the impacts on the employee. And the employer has to consider whether there are less intrusive means, which clearly didn't happen here. Arbitrator Hayes did find that the mandatory vaccination policy was reasonable at the time it was imposed. But what wasn't reasonable, according to Hayes, was the automatic terminations for cause for refusing the vaccine. So the arbitrator said it was plain and obvious that placing unvaccinated nurses on temporary unpaid leaves served the same objective as terminations. So the policy wasn't minimally impairing. These leaves might have lasted a long time, but the nurses would still have had jobs to go back to if the hospital had been more reasonable. And importantly, the arbitrator distinguished this case from another labor arbitration decision over COVID-19 vaccines in hospitals. I believe it's the only other decision so far. In that case, called Lakeridge Health, the arbitrator had found that terminating nurses rather than just putting them on leaves was reasonable, since the contract at Lakeridge would have required keeping those jobs open, which would have meant Lakeridge wouldn't have been able to replace those nurses at all. That wasn't reasonable in this case, however, because the hospital in Quinty terminated 10 unvaccinated nurses, and at one point it was short 350 nurses, so it made little difference to just keep 10 jobs open. An Another aspect of the policy that was unreasonable was not reevaluating it as time went on. Something arbitrators are increasingly pointing out is that in these types of decisions, you know, even back in September 2021, when this policy came out, there was already some evidence that the vaccines didn't prevent illness in a lot of people and that they didn't really stop transmission. And so the unreasonableness of refusing to reevaluate was further emphasized by the fact that the hospital fired an unvaccinated nurse who had returned from maternity leave in April 2023. And that's well after it was clear to everyone that almost everyone had immunity. The arbitrator also pointed out that when firing a person for cause, in this case, insubordination, usually other factors are considered, like whether there's been past discipline and the length of service, but here it was just automatic termination. He also quoted another arbitrator called Arbitrator Aish on this point, and Arbitrator Aish had said the typical justification for discipline in response to some forms of insubordination don't fit well with COVID policies, which involve the irreversible intrusion of an employee's privacy and bodily integrity associated with the policy's compliance. A policy or enforcement mechanism cannot presume insubordination with no basis for an assessment of the individual's inattention, manner, or attitude. Okay, so what happens next? Well, the policy's over at Quinty, and those 10 nurses can get their jobs back if they want. CTV's Avis Favreau, shout out to Avis. I worked with her for several years. She's great. She reports that there are 60 open nursing jobs at the hospital. So it would be good news for patients if the hospital allowed them back, because then they'd only be 50 nurses short. There may also be some financial compensation. We'll have to wait and see. Most importantly, though, the decision could force other hospitals in Ontario and British Columbia to drop their mandates, which remain in place to this date in those two provinces. It's almost unbelievable that any hospital would have kept such a policy in place, considering how harmful the nursing shortage has proven to be. So I can only hope that that happens. One last thing I'll point out before I hand it over to you, Joanna, is I'd briefly note that this week there was also a labor board decision in BC that came out, and it sided with the British Columbia Nurses Union against nurses who were fired 2.5 years ago and who had accused the union of sort of dragging their feet and refusing to properly represent them. And that's just a reminder that a lot of unvaccinated workers were at the mercy of their unions. And if unions didn't want to fight the policy, and we know lots of people who were in this boat, then the employees were pretty much out of luck. So it's good to see that the ONA went to bat for these Quinty nurses, but unfortunate that so many people had to give up their bodily autonomy and their privacy because they didn't have unions supporting them. And I think that's all I want to say. So, Joanna, I know this decision isn't one you've had a chance to read, but do you have any thoughts on the issue?
Yeah, well, so the point about the failure to reevaluate as the information and as what we understood about vaccines and transmission changed, I think, is a really important one. And this is a point that Christine and I make over and over again in our book, Pandemic Panic. And of course, here we're talking about a labor context. This is not a constitutional law issue. This was the number one question we got during the pandemic, people who were hit by these employer mandates, and that's a matter of employment law. Nonetheless, the principle and the stubborn refusal to acknowledge that reality, which really did change, right? There really was hope in early 2021, and it seemed to be backed up by preliminary data that the vaccines did stop transmission. And then with the mutation of the virus, very, very quickly that changed. And by summer of 2020, I'm trying to remember when the federal travel mandate was brought in. I think it was, it was August 2021. And by that point, with the Delta variant, any sort of connection between vaccination and lack of transmission had pretty much evaporated. And yet you saw the federal government doubling down on unvaccinated people not being able to travel on planes, trains, et cetera. And so I think it's very vindicating and correct to see an arbitrator Point out that the rationale of reducing transmission, because obviously if you work in a healthcare context, you don't want to be getting people sick, but that no longer is meaningfully connected to vaccination status. So that stood out to me about that. And then just finally, this is in this theme of decisions, and you've talked about a number of them on the podcast. I could even probably connect the dots if I wanted to be some pretty remote to Justice Mosley's decision in the Emergencies Act, is that we have seen an optimistic trend of like a sober second thought, that the pandemic hysteria seems to have waned. And it's useful to have these reminders that overreach happened, that it had no science or health basis, and a lot of people's rights were very badly infringed.
Yeah, you're totally right, Joanna. It's when you're in the middle of like an emergency, it's not all that surprising that courts are reticent to step in, because we do elect politicians to make these difficult polycentric decisions for us. But it's good to see that some common sense is prevailing as time goes on. Speaking of common sense, I think the decision you're going to talk about, the Crown and bike vets, is also a pretty good decision coming from the Supreme Court. But I haven't read it in full, so I'll need the whole synopsis from you. Why don't you tell us about it?
Okay, so major decision for privacy rights, and what is a reasonable expectation of privacy under Section 8 of the Charter, which of course protects the right against unreasonable search and seizure. So this came out last week in a decision called R.v. Bykovitz. I think it's pronounced. This was a decision coming out of Alberta. It was a 5-4 split decision, but a slim majority of the Supreme Court of Canada held that IP addresses attract a reasonable expectation of privacy. So I'll break down the decision, the majority, and the dissent. And then I have a little bit of riff about this topic, because actually when I first saw this headline of this holding, it kind of surprised me. So factual background to this is that the police investigated fraudulent purchases from an online liquor store. And this individual, Bykovitz, an Alberta resident, was convicted of using stolen credit card data to buy gift cards online. Very common practice in Canada. I think I've had about 10 credit cards that I've had to cancel because the data has been stolen. I live in a condo in downtown Toronto, and apparently our mail is like super leaky and people will get details that way. So anyways, very common, and gift cards are notoriously a high fraud risk transaction. So prior to seeking a production order under the criminal code, the cops contacted Moneris, which was the store's third party payment processor, to ask for the IP addresses used for these alleged fraudulent transactions. Moneris turned them over voluntarily. Then the cops used the IP addresses to get a court order, which compelled the ISPs, the service providers, to disclose his subscriber information, his name, his address. But they already had a court order for that. And that was based on, you know, a reasonable suspicion standard. They then executed a search warrant for Bykovitz as well as his father. And at trial, he argued that the police's request for IP addresses violated his right against unreasonable search and seizure. Alberta Court of Appeal upheld the trial court's decision that IP addresses did not attract a reasonable expectation of privacy because the IP address on its own didn't provide any identifying information. Okay, so let's turn to the SCC decision. So the Supreme Court had to decide whether this initial request to Moneris, just for the IP addresses, not for his name or biographical information or address, just the IP addresses, whether that constituted a search. And a search under the case law occurs when the state invades what we have a reasonable expectation of privacy to. And so a majority overturned the Court of Appeals decision, and they assessed in their reasoning whether IP addresses attract a reasonable expectation of privacy, considering two things primarily. First, what's the subject matter of the search? So what is the nature of an IP address? What is it disclosing? And second, whether Bykovitz had an objectively reasonable expectation of privacy in that subject matter. So in terms of the reasonable expectation of privacy, the majority of the court held that Section 8 protects informational privacy, the claims of individuals or groups or institutions to determine for themselves how and to what extent information about them is communicated to others. And the court held that this includes, and I quote, a biographical core of personal information which individuals in a free and democratic society would wish to maintain and control from dissemination to the state. And the majority, this decision was written by Justice Kara Katsanis, talks about how we have to understand Section 8 in a sort of evolving manner, which reflects the realities and ubiquitousness of the internet. She says, not only does the internet keep an accurate permanent record, it has concentrated this massive data in the hands of third parties, investing these third parties with immense informational power. It has given large private corporations the ability to collect vast stores of user information and to aggregate that data into sharp images of their users' online activity. So we know this, like the cloud has a more textured and detailed picture of me and my particular proclivities, my online shopping habits, my YouTube binging habits. Like it definitely knows me better than I know myself, which is a little bit scary. But yeah, you could divulge from my IP address a very nuanced picture about me and my tastes and my personal life.
And your politics. Which is a big part of it anyway.
Exactly. So the court finds from this that from the IP address, there is this potential to reveal personal biological core information that is enough to trigger Section 8 protection prior to disclosing an IP address. In terms of the reasonable expectation of privacy, they also noted that the IP address, although on its own, it doesn't give any names or addresses, it's a digital breadcrumb that can lead the state on the trail of an individual's internet activity. So they really focus on the IP address as a piece of a broader whole. So turning to the objective reasonableness of a subjective expectation of privacy, the majority rejected an argument that the Crown made at the appeal that expectation is unreasonable because the court has a prior ruling in a case called R.V. Spencer, which requires the cops to obtain a warrant to obtain the internet user's name and address from the service provider. And that IP address on its own would be useless without what is called commonly a Spencer warrant. They held this because before even obtaining a Spencer warrant for the subscriber information, accessing the IP address on its own allows the cops already to access deeply revealing information, which we've gone through. And the court talks about online chat rooms. Are online chat rooms still a thing, Josh? Or is this like a boomer comment?
I think that's an extreme boomer comment, but you know, Reddit exists and there's, you know, things on the dark web where people chat, and I don't know anyone calls it chat rooms, but
yeah,
so chat room like activities, let's say.
Yeah, they talk about medical, political, dating services, accessing adult pornography. I mean, this is stuff that people definitely do. And they note that if the IP address, which can disclose all of these proclivities, is not protected, this information is freely available to the state without the protection of the charter, whether or not it relates to the investigation of a particular crime. Okay, so yes, IP addresses, requesting IP addresses is a search that has to be protected by Section 8. So that would mean the cops need to get a warrant before they can ask for that from, let's say, a payment processor or a website, or I would assume even like an email service provider. Okay, so let's turn to the dissent. So the dissent was written by Justice Suzanne Côté, who is kind of famous for being the dissent queen. Justice Côté, as well as the three other dissenting judges, would have held that the IP address in this case did not attract a reasonable expectation of privacy because the IP addresses themselves reveal nothing more than like a string of numbers, an IP address. And They say that when assessing the subject matter of an alleged search, the court's task is to determine what the police were really after. And the court is concerned with the capacity of the precise information sought, in this case, IP addresses, to give rise to inferences or to reveal further information. And this forms part of the true subject matter of the search. They thought that the requirement to obtain a Spencer warrant, which is, again, a warrant that is usually directed at an internet service provider to reveal subscriber information, that provides adequate protection. So that ensures that cops cannot obtain this actually identifying information from ISPs or about internet activity associated with ISPs from third-party websites without prior third-party impartial judicial authorization based on reasonable suspicion grounds. The dissent also disagreed with the majority that the subject matter was the identity of an internet user, which corresponds to a particular IP address linked to a particular monitored internet activity. While that may be the ultimate goal of the investigation, it's not information that is revealed or can be somehow inferred by the raw IP addresses alone. Therefore, that is not the subject matter of the search. And so basically the point of the dissent is that an IP address is just a string of numbers. It provides very limited information. And if the cops or the prosecutors want to go further than that, they need to get a Spencer warrant. And the Spencer warrant is issued on a reasonable suspicion basis. It doesn't even reveal, according to the dissent, browsing habits. It just reveals a user's ISP, which is not really meaningfully more private than either electricity usage or heat emissions. So kind of like the nub of the disagreement between the majority and the minority is the majority says you need to look at this holistically. You need to look at where the IP address request, where that's ultimately heading, which is to a Spencer warrant and to getting subscriber information. And so if you need a warrant to get subscriber information, it makes no sense to say that you shouldn't also need it to get an IP address. I think this is correct. I think the majority is correct. I think clearly using the internet, I mean, the internet is life. It's clearly an expressive function. It's clearly protected as a liberty interest, a very strong liberty interest. And the idea that I should have to use a VPN to make sure that the state cannot surveil my digital life without some type of prior judicial authorization strikes me as correct. And I think the CCLA, which intervened in this case, also made the point that for cops to get cell tower data, so you know where your location at any given time, that also requires a warrant. And so there's no principled reason why IP addresses shouldn't require a warrant. But when I saw this headline, I was a little bit confused because I thought it was kind of trite law that IP addresses on their own are not particularly probative of anything, that IP addresses can only be used as a basis for drawing inferences with not just biographical information, but also something like circumstantial evidence. So I'll explain my experience with this. I don't think I've ever talked about this, but this was actually the case that convinced me that I did not have a long time future in criminal law. So about 10 years ago, when I was working as a criminal defense lawyer, we worked on a case called Viscomi, which was a guy in like his late 20s who lived in Stouffville. He was a med student. And his thing was, and all of this is obviously like a matter of open court at this point. None of this is secret. This has all been detailed and he's been convicted of it. And his thing was going on to, I guess, online chat rooms, or I'm not sure exactly where he was going, and approaching young girls. My understanding is they were 10, 11, 12, and threatening to put like a Trojan virus on their computer or like other threats if they didn't send him pictures of themselves naked and performing violent and graphic sex acts. Like really, really horrible stuff. And so we, you know, acted as his counsel. In this case, though, it was an extradition matter. ultimately the girls who complained, who he had victimized, were based in Virginia Beach. And so the American authorities had charged him and he was wanted to be extradited to stand trial in Virginia Beach. And the record of the case that the U.S. prosecutors had provided, record of the case is basically like a summary of the charges and a preliminary view of the evidence that would justify us extraditing, sending one of our citizens to stand trial in the U.S. And it was particularly high stakes in this case because he was actually facing the prospect of capital punishment, of being killed by the state. But our argument on this extradition matter was that the record of the case only referred to its evidence for connecting Viscomi to the person who went into these chat rooms or on these Skype calls and committed these heinous acts was just an IP address. It was just an IP address, and that IP address had then been connected by a Spencer warrant to his address in Stouffville, Ontario. And Justice Blair found that just like proving that a given car by its registration papers, like if somebody stole my car and got into a car accident, it was registered to me, that wouldn't be sufficient to get ground a reasonable suspicion that I had, you know, committed the act of dangerous driving. Just an IP address, even with subscriber information, is not sufficient preliminary evidence for the purpose of extradition to say that this was the guy that got online from that house. There could be many other people in that house. There could be somebody else using his IP address. So the extradition request was denied, which was a win. I think that this is a correct principle. All the while, though, right after we had won our appeal and we're kind of celebrating because, you know, when you're a criminal defense lawyer, these things are about the broader precedence that they set. We got a call from the cops. So the client was obviously being held in custody. We got a call from the cop saying, you know, congratulations on your win. In the meantime, though, we have seized his laptops and computers and we've gone through his computer and found that not only did he do this, he did this with like 60 different girls. So we're going to go in and rearrest him on a new warrant. And I guess I can talk about this now almost 10 years later that for me, I was like, okay, fair enough. We did our job. We got this enduring precedent out of the Court of Appeal. This guy is sick. And, you know, if the cops can build a case that does connect him directly to this conduct, he ought to be arrested. Like, my boss at the time, however, was very upset and felt that we'd failed, that it wasn't good enough for my boss. So I realized if this is what criminal defense is about, this is probably not for me in the long run. So Josh, I know that is a lot of dense information. Any thoughts?
Yeah, well, my main thought is I think a lot of people, including a lot of judges, don't really understand why we have Section 8. And it goes back to England, where the king was going into people's houses who had printed things that the king didn't like without a warrant and going after his political enemies. And this idea got sort of transplanted into US law and then also into Canadian law. And so what Section 8 is really about is preventing dragnets and preventing people from going after their political enemies. And the way that we prevent this sort of, you know, surveillance state from emerging is through warrants, where you just have to, you know, if you're a member of the state, which has huge power, whether you're a police officer or some other part of the state, by going to the judiciary, which is a part of the state that's not interested in going after you politically, just for that check to make sure that they're not, you know, building some surveillance apparatus or going after political enemies through some dragnet. That's the way we do it, is through judicial authorization. And here it's like, okay, the IP address itself in most cases is not going to be very useful information. But if, you know, say like the state starts collecting the IP addresses of all kinds of people they suspect of being some like minority political group that threatens them, just having that information, one day they will be able to potentially use that and go rogue. So you want to prevent that from happening in the first place. And to get these judicial authorizations, like, it's a low standard reason to suspect. It's, you don't need all that much information to get them, and you can just fax that to a justice of the peace, right? Like, you don't even need to go in person to get that. So it's not a hugely onerous thing, but it does prevent these government dragnets and these government surveillance programs, which do happen. Like, we've seen examples of that in the past. For example, I think it was Toronto Police. It was a police service in Ontario, certainly, that was using like facial recognition technology secretly without anybody knowing and collecting that en masse. And, you need to have authorization so that we know that that's going on and we know whether or not the government's going after us. Oh, one other thing I was going to say is I wasn't surprised to see the majority was written by Justice Kara Katsanis, because in past Section 8 cases, she seems to be the person on the court who maybe understands this stuff best. It's unfortunate that it was a close decision, because I think it should be obvious that that IP addresses are the type of information that police can't just, you know, get without any sort of authorization. I don't have that much more to say about this, Joanna. Maybe we should take a break, and after we come back, we'll do our bad legal takes.
Sounds good.
Hi, I'm Russell from the CCF. In case you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to our email newsletter, The Freedom Update, to get updates from me every week about our ongoing work and the legal stories in Canada that keep us interested. Along with our new podcast, Not Reserving Judgment, it's one of the best ways to stay up to date. Subscribe at theccf.ca/freedomupdate.
My bad legal take this week goes to the City of London municipal councillors who voted in favor of directing staff to draft a bylaw to ban certain kinds of anti-abortion signs. And some councillors in London say they're getting complaints that anti-abortion activists are displaying fetuses on signs while standing on the sidewalk, and that these graphic images are traumatizing for some people to see, and so they need to be banned. But I think we've probably all seen these signs, and they can be pretty upsetting. But of course, that's the point that the activists are trying to make, that abortion is upsetting because in their view, a fetus is a human being. And the bad legal take goes to Councillor Hadley McAllister, a man, I presume, based on his beard, although you never know these days. Maybe the better term, according to the Supreme Court's latest decision, is non-vagina haver.
Oh, but...
I can cut that out if you want.
It's okay. It's horrible.
McAllister said these images are targeted towards women and contrary to the city's goal to, quote, make the city a safe city for women, girls, and those identifying as such. McAllister says, quote, you can have your opinions, absolutely, but I don't think you should traumatize people to make your point. Well, the charter right is not just about having opinions. It's about government not stepping in with laws that limit expressing those opinions in public places like sidewalks, including and especially controversial and offensive opinions. And McAllister's claim that people are traumatized by seeing images they don't like is what those opposed to freedom of expression have always historically said. They always say that the speech is making people unsafe, but words, and in this case, graphic images, aren't violent. They're at most uncomfortable. And I know they cause some people some real anguish. I get that, but they're not a punch in the face. And it's only actual violence that's excluded outright from protection under 2B. So yes, there are reasonable limits. There's also time, place, and manner restrictions. But if we let politicians completely ban certain speech based on content just because someone claims it's traumatizing, then a future city councilor with different views can restrict different speech that their side claims is making people unsafe or is traumatizing. And pretty soon we have no controversial speech at all, and we just have the received wisdom like they do in China or Russia. One example of this that I thought of is, you know, what if some far right city council was elected and said two men holding hands is traumatizing to them, and they decide to ban that form of expression? Like, where does it end? And as unlikely as that is, it's my point is just that it goes both ways, and you need really hard, clear lines that yes, you can express your views in public, even if they're controversial or uncomfortable, as long as you don't cross into violence. And I mean actual violence, not word violence. Before I wrap up, I just wanted to say I watched about 10 minutes of the debate on this apparently pressing issue of whether to ban certain speech from sidewalks in London, Ontario. And it was kind of funny because Mr. McAllister, this counselor who's in favor of it, was challenged by a female counselor, Counselor Stevens, who said she was concerned more about the charter rights of women than the so-called trauma from seeing these signs. And this prompted Mr. McAllister to jump up on a point of order to clarify that he was not trying to speak for women. And I found this hilarious because it made me think he's just taken like one too many gender studies classes at Western or something. It's also interesting to note that this motion to draft a bylaw was nowhere near unanimous. It passed 9-6, and at least one of those who voted in favor seemed not very impressed with the idea of bylaw officers prioritizing a crackdown on free expression over all of the other serious problems that London has. So it's possible that he could change his vote, and maybe this ill-conceived plan won't go ahead. So I'll certainly be keeping an eye on this, but I do think that it's constitutionally questionable. And as much as I understand people are offended or disturbed by seeing that particular speech, I don't think it should be banned. So that's my bad legal take. Joanna, what's yours?
Okay, so my bad legal take of the week goes to Caitlin Dick, who describes herself as a criminal defense, an appeal lawyer, and abolitionist. And this is in response to the recent news that an individual named Joseph Skelly, who is a butcher in Alberta, dismembered a woman named Teresa Lynn Oberle's body in his garage. He burned some of the remains, buried the rest in a shallow grave, and he was given a community sentence rather than a sentence of jail. So that's a community sentence served in the community. And Caitlin tweets, "I feel compelled to point out that a CSO, a community sentence, is a sentence of jail served in the community. The SCC has acknowledged that it can be a punitive sentence and usually includes a significant loss of liberty." So again, this is in the context of somebody who committed one of the most heinous crimes that we can imagine. And look, I'm no, you know, prison maximalist. I'm not into locking them up, but it's just a logical fallacy to say that a community sentence in which you're allowed to stay in your house and you don't go to jail is the same as a sentence of jail. A sentence of jail served in the community. No, a sentence of jail is a sentence of jail. And I think it's perfectly appropriate to take objection to this particular sentence. Now, it could be that he's elderly. It could be that there are other mitigating factors. But no, a community sentence is not, strictly speaking, a sentence to jail. A community sentence is a community sentence. So bad legal take, Caitlin.
Bad legal take indeed. As usual, we hope you'll rate us, review us, and subscribe. And I really do mean go rate us and review us now, or I will accuse you of traumatizing me and I'll complain to City Council. And just a reminder, you can support our work by subscribing to the CCF's YouTube channel, by following us on Twitter, or by visiting our website, theccf.ca, where you can sign up for our new and improved Freedom Update newsletter. The Canadian Constitution Foundation is a nonpartisan legal charity funded by your donations, so please click that donate button on our website if you can. Thanks for listening.